Welcome back to Through the Word. I'm your host, Peyton Jones, and today we'll be in 2 Kings chapter 15. In the 2004 Summer Olympics, Michael Phelps burst on the scene and swiped gold medals for the American team. But there was also a competitor who lost gold medals, and he lost it the hard way. American shooter Matt Emmons was so far ahead of his competitors in the rifle event that he was a sure win. All he had to do in the final round was just hit the target. That means just a bullet hitting the piece of paper would have been enough for him to secure the gold medal. It didn't matter where on the target he hit as long as it hit any part of it. Well, he flexed, he breathed, he took careful aim, bam, the shot rang out. But when the judges looked at the papers, there wasn't a mark. He had accidentally shot the target next to him, his competitor's target. Not only did he lose the gold, he didn't place at all after that shot. Now remember Matt Emmons and learn the lesson. Don't aim for the wrong target. The frustrating thing about reading the Book of Kings is that all any of them had to do was simply listen to the prophets, listen to the word, listen to the law, aim at the right target, simply follow God and stop worshiping idols. But following God isn't always that simple, is it? Too many times, we are simply in our own way. We're locked onto the wrong target, and therefore, what should have been easy seems hopelessly out of reach. And man, when you read 2 Kings chapter 15, you can see that the people back then loved their idols. Man, did they love their high places. In fact, all the way throughout this book, we keep saying that they did not abolish the high places. Well, what exactly were the high places? I mean, was it like the London Eye or the Empire State Building? Well, the high places were places on a hill or a mountain that were considered closer to the gods. Therefore, people would worship there. If you remember, the only place that a Jew was supposed to worship God was the temple. Why? Well, it was a symbol that atonement and forgiveness could only be found one place, and that's Jesus. When Jesus came, he would say, "I am the temple." After all, it was Jesus alone who paid for our sins. As Hebrews says, therefore, because the blood of bulls and goats could not atone for sins, God sent his Son. Jesus came for this very purpose. Dying in our place, he would become the one place that would mediate between heaven and earth. The temple symbolizes that one place, the one person who alone could serve as the place we need to come to be made right with God. If you want to be forgiven, come to Christ, not to the temple. Every other way, every other religion, every other philosophy or attempt is merely a high place, while there's only one place to have your sin dealt with. An unauthorized cheap imitation of the original may get you an E for effort, but it ain't going to get you atonement. Well, so far, we've been reading the book of the histories. And if you like history, well, this chapter is going to be for you. And if you can't stand history, well, congratulations to making it to chapter 15 of 2 Kings, because so far, you have done awesome. You should probably get a gold medal for Bible reading. I have some good news and I have some bad news. Good news first? Okay. The good news is, you're still reading the Bible, so there's going to be some blessing in reading this history. The bad news is, well, it's still history, and if you don't like history, it's still history. A lot of history. In fact, 38 verses in this chapter summarizing the reigns of 7 kings, 2 in the southern kingdom of Judah and 5 in the northern kingdom of Israel. The breakdown of this chapter is that we're going to cycle through a king sandwich. The two pieces of bread on each end are like the rye bread of the two kings of the southern kingdoms of Judah. And the meat in between is the 5 slices of corned beef in the form of the 5 kings of northern Israel. See, I just made a mental Reuben sandwich. You see what I did? And I wrote this a few days ago, and I got a Reuben on the day I did this. And guess what I'm having for dinner tonight? No joke, I actually need to go eat a Reuben sandwich now. But do you see that the rye, the corned beef, Reuben, one of the tribes of Israel? So if the Reuben sandwich distracted you as much as it did me, just know that we're going to start off with the southern king of Judah, cycle through five northern kings of Israel, and then end the chapter with one more southern king of Judah. That's the breakdown of the chapter. And in case you're wondering, today's Through the Word will provide the sauerkraut, special sauce, and Swiss cheese. I don't know about you, but I may not be able to wait till dinner now to get that Reuben. But in the first section, we see Azariah, the first piece of Reuben bread in our king sandwich. This is found in verses 1 through 6, and we have the account of Azariah, the leper king of Judah, the southern kingdom, who followed the Lord, but again did not remove the high places. He lived in isolation, and his son Jotham, seen at the end of the chapter, reigned and governed for him due to his leprosy. Moving to the meat, in verses 13 through 16, we have our first slice of corned beef, Zechariah, king of Israel, up in the north. This king reigned only 6 months before being assassinated by his own men in public. Verse 12 tells us, "So the word of the Lord spoken to Jehu was fulfilled. Your descendants will sit on the throne of Israel to the fourth generation." He was assassinated by Shallum, who becomes the next king, but not for long. Our second king in Israel, Shallum, or a next piece of corned beef, gets the award for the least time on the throne. Not necessarily an award anybody wants. He reigns for 1 month before he was assassinated by Menahem. Sounds a bit like clearing your throat. And this disgusting character was a bit phlegmy anyways, or a bit phlegmatic, reigning for 10 years. He's more ruthless than anything so far. He wants to keep his reign and rule at all costs, so when the Assyrians come through again in their rise to power as they build the Assyrian Empire, Menahem buys them off by raising taxes. Now Israel exists to pay off a foreign king. And when Menahem dies, Pekahiah reigns for 2 years. He's assassinated by one of his officers, and you know what? This is kind of the point of the entire chapter, to show the downward spiral that's happening on every front. They weren't just in danger from without, you see. Their worst enemies were from within. I don't know if you've ever felt that way, like you were your own worst enemy. I know that I am. In medieval Britain, a castle wall was the greatest type of defense you could have. But there was a feature built into almost every castle called the Traitor Gate. It was a small opening somewhere else in the castle, usually hidden, usually intended to be used for escape for the ruler or king if something got particularly bad. Well, I've got a traitor gate in my heart, and there's this traitor named Peyton Jones who sometimes opens the door to the enemy, knowing that it will lead to destruction in my life. Maybe the enemy promises me great gains or something to enrich my life, but he lies. He doesn't care about me. His battle is with my king, and he wants to destroy the castle and not let God rule over it. But he needs my help to make that happen. And one of the best ways to win the battle against the enemy is to completely seal up the traitor's gate. That's why we're told not to give the devil a foothold or an opportunity. Because brother, believe me, and sister, he'll take it every chance he gets. You know, Matt Emmons must have felt like his own worst enemy as well during the Olympics. In fact, he wasn't even beaten by his competitors. He was his own worst enemy and his own greatest competitor, and he screwed it up for himself. Hey, Matt Emmons, if you're listening right now, I'm sorry, I'm not picking on you, brother. We're all in the same boat. You know, while we're on this topic, though, I know that all kinds of nastiness is on the other side of my phone screen and computer. Therefore, I've got every device protected with software that prevents pornography. Can you imagine not having to worry about that in your life? I find that this is one of the most tempting traitor gates in modern society. And the problem is that studies show that pornography isn't something you do that just doesn't hurt anyone else. Every click means money to the party on the other side of the screen. And many of the sites rely on sex trafficking and the money from advertising to pay for it. Perhaps there's a big studio producing pornography and you think, oh, that's not hurting anyone. But it's hurting those performers. Those clicks from the computer fuel and fund money as the studios are paid per view from advertisers. And they get more advertisers based on the more views, and that's where you come in. The person getting hurt the most, though, is you. In the book, The Brain That Changes Itself, about neuroplasticity, or how the brain changes with use, neuroscientists have discovered that porn has negative effects on our libido that can be carried down through our DNA. Addiction is indeed inheritable, but the pattern can be broken if you want to break it bad enough. Jesus said that if something causes you to sin, cut it off. It's a traitor. It may be that you can't trust yourself with a smartphone, or maybe you need to go to the public library to use a computer. It might seem extreme, right? Like not having a computer at home? Yes. Yes, it is. And Jesus was being extreme when he said cut off the hand or poke out the eye. Of course, he didn't mean mutilate yourself literally, but both of those things are things that you think you need and can't live without. Like a computer, we therefore make excuses. I may need to remind you that using a computer is still possible without having one in your home. And if you need to do that for a year just to cut off the addiction, there are ways to do it, and there is hope. Unfortunately, we don't hear that message often enough. After years of being a pastor and counseling many new believers through life change, it became something that we were able to help people through, but at a cost. Like AA and Narcotics Anonymous will tell you, we have to want to change bad enough. It's what the recovery community calls hitting rock bottom, where the desire to be free from addiction finally outweighs the desire for what you're addicted to. And to get to that point nearly destroys the addict in the process. But the key is that by that time, they finally want it bad enough. Bad enough to get help. Bad enough to do what's necessary to make the change. And for change to happen, you have to want it badly. And the point is, in this chapter, none of these kings really did. How's that for some sauerkraut? Oh, and Pekah, our last slice of northern Israel corned beef in the sarnie, you guessed it. He was assassinated just like the others, and he was evil. It may sound like a broken record, but it's really driving the point home in this chapter. These guys were lost. Despite God sending them prophets and warnings and messages and even help, they persisted in their self-rule. Finally, the chapter closes with Jotham, king of Judah, this last king in this chapter of Kings. He's the other piece of bread, making our Reuben sandwich fit for a king. The summary of his reign is found in verses 32 to 38. He did okay, but he didn't, you know what I was about to say. He left the traitor gate open. Well, read through the Word, chapter 15 today, and we'll see you tomorrow on our journey through the Word.
Join us next time as we continue the journey, one chapter at a time. And remember, faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the Word.